One of the hottest topics today in management development circles is the concept of team building. How does one go about putting together all the factors which affect work group interaction in such a way that a high-performance team results? How do you put a group of people together with a common mission in a common location and ask them to be uncommon winners? What are the elements that add up to team success? No manager can do this job all by himself or herself. Every manager must rely on the talents and the skills of others and control the factors that go into successful team play. A few years ago, I was watching Monday Night Football when the Dallas Cowboys were playing. I noticed a piece of management behavior as the coach gave a play to his quarterback, who then went in and executed it perfectly. In management terms, what I was seeing was the management principle of delegation. I suppose I've watched a lot of sports contests over the years and never really considered the connection between management of large organizations and that of running a sports team. That evening, I grabbed a legal pad and started jotting down all the specific management examples that were coming out of that sports contest. The next day, I read with a different perspective the account of the game in the newspaper. Danny White, the quarterback, made a comment that in the end, they had won because... And his opposing number was quoted as saying, "In the end, we lost because..." And then they'd fill in the blank. In each case, there was an explanation being given by an expert observer, somebody who was there, somebody who knew the situation, a summary statement of what made them win or lose. And what they were describing in each instance was a piece of management. I started to collect these newspaper stories a couple years ago and put them in a file. I gathered about 400 that contained these comments. I pulled them out one day and said to myself, I'm going to see if there's some pattern that seems to emerge from all this. And you know, I did find some pattern elements. I found in the direct experience of these professionals six major headlines that contributed to their success. Six major factors that have to be managed well if you want to create a winning team at work. I'd like to present these to you, those things which players and coaches say contributed to their team-building success. And the analogy that I'm suggesting is that what it takes to win in competitive sports is precisely what it takes to win in running any department, any business, any organization. Now, the fancy term for this simple concept is game theory. The study of games shows that to win, there are certain factors that must be managed, certain strategies that must be pursued, and certain dispositions people have to bring to the game to win. Once these simple elements were understood, they were applied to larger, more complex situations. And this simple model was found to hold up remarkably well in understanding how complex organizations must operate if they're to be successful. Now, the problem with any analogy is that it is never perfect. I would not say to you that winning a sports contest is as complex as running your business. A team has to look good for an hour a week. You have to look good for 40. They must perform well for a season. You have to do well year after year. They must follow the rules of the game, and your rules are infinitely more complex. So I'd like you to listen critically to this analogy, and you be the judge as to whether you see in these stories what I saw. As I've presented this model to a large number of management audiences, I've found that it really connects. It strikes them as being right on the money and squaring with their own experience. My purpose is not to glorify sports or suggest that as difficult as it is to win in sport, that it's just as easy to win the tougher game that you're playing in. I do think that in the complexity of what you're dealing with, we often get lost in it all. We fail to see the common, simple fundamentals that have to be mastered, and that is the value of what we'll be talking about. So what I'm doing is reasoning by analogy. In sport, we have a group of people with a set of objectives who must outperform a competitor, must follow some rules, and who must play with strength and courage in order to win. My intent is not to glorify sport, or to say that we should manage our organizations the way a coach runs a football team. What I am trying to say is that the principles of management that work in competitive sport, when we fall back, when we retreat from this microcosm and look at the far greater complexity of organization living may still apply. And the reaction of the thousands of managers I've presented this model to suggests that there is a great deal of transferability. If we want to build a winning team, it's important to have a clear definition of what those words mean. What is the definition of winning? I guess everybody has their own definition of what it means to win. One of the most famous was Vince Lombardi's quotation, "Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing." Winning is not a sometime thing. It's an all-time thing. You don't win once in a while. You don't do things right once in a while. You do them right all the time. There is no room for second place. There is only one place, and that's first place. Certainly that's a strong statement. Some would object to it. They would say that it shows too much emphasis on winning, that it doesn't matter whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game. Think that statement through. Picture going into your boss's office and saying, "Boss, it doesn't matter whether we win in making our productivity and profit numbers. It's how we play the game." If you're a nurse manager, picture going into a patient room where 69-year-old Mrs. Brown is gasping for breath under the oxygen tent. Say to her, "It doesn't matter whether you win or lose this battle for life that you're in. It's how you play the game." And then picture her passing along this bit of wisdom to her son, the attorney. "Of course it matters whether we win. What else is there?" Woody Hayes said, "I don't want to be a good loser, because you have to lose to prove it. There is no laughter in losing. There is no joy in defeat." Teams understand this, but sometimes I wonder if businesses do. Too many American organizations continue to lose in the marketplace, continue to be defeated, and you get the impression that losing has become a way of life to them. There is no room for second place. There's only one place, and that's first place. When Mike Ditka took over as head coach of the Chicago Bears, the team had developed losing into a high art form. His first season with the Bears, and every season since, has been a winning season. One newspaper article caught the essence of Ditka in an article entitled, "The Coach Who Hates to Lose." Mike is quoted as saying, "I really believe this. If you accept defeat, then you're going to be defeated a heck of a lot more than you're going to win. You can be gracious in defeat, but boy, I'll tell you what, you can be gracious on the outside, but you better be doing flip-flops inside. If you're not churning and turning, you're going to go out and get your butt whipped next time out. That's all there is to it. You'll start accepting it." I'm not sure that isn't what happened with the Bears for a while. They didn't like losing, but it seemed to be a way of life, so they accepted it. You find ways to blow games. That's bull. I don't believe in it. End of quote. A lot of people say they want to win, but do you really hate to lose? What does winning mean to you? I don't think you can build a winning team until that's crystal clear in your mind. Have you such a picture, a vision, a goal, and have you committed to it? I don't think you can ever build a team until you've made a commitment, the commitment to win with that team. I just don't think it's possible to fire people up in the absence of a sense of wanting to win and being ready to pay the price that winning requires. Now let's talk about the definition of the word team. The definition of the word team from Webster's International Dictionary is that it is a number of persons associated in some joint action. The first concept is that it's not a solo performance. It is not something done by a single person alone. It is a number of persons who are associated. They are affiliated. They are with each other in some form of relationship. A team is a group of people who are involved in joint action. Certainly, as we think about the work setting and the activity that must go on there, if we can be doing that in an associated fashion, not in a disassociated fashion, why then we're probably going to be in a better position to win. It's in the effective interplay where each lends strength to the other. Each person is choreographed in a supportive web of interactive behavior. I cover first, you cover third, Mary will take second, and everybody wins. The dictionary also defines a team as being especially one of the sides in a contest. I like that definition of team because it suggests that this is a competition. What it suggests is that we're in a race, we're involved in a contest. In business, that contest has to do with productivity. That contest has to do with profitability. That contest has to do with excellence and with quality. There is, in fact, a challenge environment within which the team functions. I am sometimes struck by the gray area which exists within some organizations. These organizations lack the sense that they're involved in one of the most challenging, exciting arenas of life, the opportunity to do something in their work life. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're out to defeat a competitor. It may really be a question of being out to defeat our own track records. We're out to surpass ourselves in excellence. And that provides a purpose to our work, a motivating sense of elation and feeling within the group that's missing in many work groups. And I think that organizations suffer without it. The dictionary also says that a team is defined as a joining together into a band for cooperative effort. The concept of team here is defined as a joining or a welding, a coming together. I have been in work units, and perhaps you have, where there really isn't any sense of joint effort, where in fact it's a matter of people reporting to the same address, to the same geographic location, but there's no sense of relationship among them. There's no sense of coordination or communication among them. It's really everybody out for themselves. There's been no joining together. Sometimes with professional sports teams, you'll see the same thing. They all wear the same uniform, but they sure don't play like they're involved with other team members. No team is ever just one player, no matter how good the player is. With that by way of definition, let me share with you the 6 headlines of success that I extracted from several hundred stories of winning teams in professional sports. The first of these is that winning teams have clear coaching and leadership. I never read about a team winning a championship who had a wimp as a coach. There doesn't seem to be any doubt about the fact among winning teams that somebody is in charge. Sometimes this person in charge has a personality that's about as smooth as a concrete wall. People criticize Bobby Knight for throwing a chair across the floor in an Indiana University basketball game. Certainly this is not the smoothest of personalities. But I noticed that nobody complained when he won the NCAA championship that year. In other cases, the winning coach is very smooth, very adept, very much an individual with the swathes. But in either case, there is no doubt that the coach is in charge. The kind of coaching and leadership that this individual provides is usually along 2 major dimensions that an Ohio State leadership study found to be absolutely essential in leadership of groups anywhere. The first thing the coach or a leader has to provide, said the Ohio State leadership study, is that this is somebody who sets up a high structure situation. Now, by high structure, we mean a coach who spells out a lot of rules, high standards of performance. In short, somebody who calls the plays. To depart from our analogy for a moment, it was found that often parochial schools are better at getting academic performance from students simply because they insisted on high discipline levels. Among sports teams, winning coaches are the kinds of people who aren't afraid to call the plays and to lay down what has to be done. They do not make the mistake of thinking that someone else will do it or that things will take care of themselves. They do not abdicate their role of being the leader and pointing out the direction clearly. The second factor of effective leadership was what the Ohio State study referred to as high consideration. This was somebody who, although he may have been tough and a disciplinarian, even though she may have been a very stern taskmaster, he or she was also someone who did what they did because they cared. It was somebody who was connected to the team as a human being. So the individual had 2 aspects to their leadership and coaching. They provided a high structure and called the plays, and at the same time, everybody knew they were cared about. Paul Bear Bryant for years was the head football coach at the University of Alabama. At one time, he held the record for winning more games than any other college football coach in history. Year after year, the University of Alabama football team, with great consistency, had winning seasons. He was a great coach, a legendary leader. Each year, he would start off the season by talking to all the new players. They were thrilled to be in his presence. To be selected to be on Bear's team was a great honor, and they knew it. And they knew that being coached by him meant a promising future in professional ball. He was a developer of winners. And so he would come striding into the locker room, bellowing, "How many of you believe that football is first in your life?" And these kids, all excited, would shout back, "Yeah, coach, yeah." And Bryant would respond, "You're all wrong. Your God is first in your life. Your family is second in your life. Getting good grades and graduating from the University of Alabama is third in your life. And playing winning football is fourth in your life. Do you hear me?" And they'd all shout, "Yeah, coach, yeah." They had to attend church every Sunday. They had to write their parents weekly. They had to make good grades or they couldn't play ball. Those kids learned to play the game as well as anybody, and they learned it willingly because they had a coach that cared. A third characteristic of clear coaching and leadership is that these were people known for tough decision-making, people who had enough personal strength that they were even willing to forego popularity if that was necessary. Winning coaches aren't concerned with winning everybody's popularity contest or as being known as Mr. Nice Guy. It was an interesting indication of strength. Many of us don't have the ego strength to be willing to take a lot of criticism from our players. We all want to be liked, and I can understand that normal human feeling. But the winning coaches seem to be those who are willing to forego popularity, if that's what it takes, in order to win. "You don't have to like me. You don't have to want me as your best buddy. Just do the work and follow the game plan. Just win." These leaders also seem to be those who made a decision before the fact to win. That is, before the championship rings and the trophies are given out. This was an individual who announced to the press, to the team, and most importantly to himself or herself, "We are going to win. The decision has been made. We are going to win. And now we simply have to figure out how we're going to do it." In January 1987, the Los Angeles Lakers won the National Basketball Association championship. On the very day of that victory, their coach, Pat Riley, announced that his team would win the championship again in 1988. A lot of people criticized him for that statement. It put a lot of pressure on the team in the following season. But one thing was very clear. The team knew what kind of expectations the coach had. He didn't say it's okay to be number two or just to have a winning season. The goal is to win. And in 1988, the Lakers again won the championship. It's that kind of commitment, before the fact, before the season, that is a delineating factor in terms of those who win in management and those who don't. Some people expect to somehow just wake up someday with a winning season. Others make the decision before the fact. We're going to win. And now the question is simply, how do we do it? A second major trend or headline that I saw among winning teams as I poured through these articles is that all of them have an intensive people training and development focus. I never saw a team win that didn't have spring training, and I noticed that they had it every year. They may have a farm system or some kind of feeder system. They recruit and select the best people they can find who need the least training. But most importantly, they take the talent they had and developed it. Now notice that they aren't training people who just walked in off the street. They're training the most talented, strongest athletes in the country. If there's a group that needs the training the least, it would have to be the best, most gifted athletes. But these are the ones that winning teams train the hardest. These are teams that tend to win, and they win as a result of their focus on the potential strengths that already exist within their people. I don't think they'd be involved in all this training work if they didn't have a strong belief that as good as their players were, they could give even more, could be even better players of the game. Now, how do you go about this training and development? That, too, seems to be a difference between winning and losing teams. While every team in the professional leagues has a spring training program or a preseason training program, not all of them win. What accounts for the difference in the way in which they go about this training focus? First, I would say that winning teams tend to be those that have training that is oriented toward the game plan. They're oriented toward a basic playbook. Now, there are a few football teams, for example, that can succeed with a very fancy playbook system. If you've ever watched the Dallas Cowboys on television, it's like watching ballet. Every time they take the field, they've got a new position. Everybody is dodging from this location to that location. It's orchestrated well, and most years they perform well. But the teams that win in professional football and in other professional sports tend to be those that follow the concept of playing the fundamentals. Rather than trying to master 100 different moves, let's master those moves in each position that can be successfully carried off by average or better than average players on a consistent basis. In other words, what are the most basic things that need to be learned? Vince Lombardi said, "I'm not interested in fancy plays, I'm interested in touchdowns." And the playbook that he gave his players to learn was so slim, there were so few plays in it, that it was said that you could predict 80% of the time in any given situation the play that Lombardi would call. That is, if you were the opposition team, you knew what Lombardi was going to do next because he just played fundamental football. And what was so maddening to NFL coaches was that even though you knew what he was going to throw at you, you couldn't defend against it because the execution was perfect. You see, rather than fragmenting his players' training time, he had concentrated all of it into the perfecting of the fundamentals and made excellence the result. Think about your own work unit. What are the most basic tasks in each of the positions reporting to you? How well do each of your players perform in those basic and most important fundamentals? There's lots of things you could be teaching them, but you would be better off if you sent them to a training program or you did some personal coaching with them that was related to the primary game plan of the unit. What are you there to accomplish? What are the major things that have to be done and done extremely well? Focus scarce training resources at that point. That at least is a practice that I see most commonly among winning teams. Another characteristic of the development focus of winning teams is that they believe in the growth capacity of people. Some coaches may be going through the motions, and other coaches are going at it with a vengeance. This belief in the growth capacity of other people is an essential characteristic that we see among winning teams, and we do not see it among losers. Another story from the press will illustrate the point. When Dick Vermeil retired as head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles, he had earned a reputation for working as hard as anybody possibly can work at coaching. He was known to sleep in his office during the active football season. He drove himself at least as hard as anybody else that he supervised, perhaps too hard. I was interested to read what he had to say about potentials and what he believed about the people on his team. A newspaper reporter wrote, "Character is a common noun of his, and so is commitment, and so too is he frequently saying, 'If you don't demand much of yourself, you don't get much.' Success happens when you reach your ability and then reach beyond." The writer then went on to quote Vermeil as saying, "We have a guy, Louis Giamona, who gave a guy against Minnesota a heck of a hit on a punt return last week. I didn't teach him to hit that way, and none of our other coaches did either, but the key is to recognize people who are capable of doing that and then give them the chance to do it. Look at some of the people who make us what we are. Bernard Wilson and Herman Edwards weren't even drafted, but they start for us. Woody Peoples couldn't play for San Francisco, but he plays for us. Rodney Parker couldn't play for Atlanta, but he plays for us. Nobody wanted Guy Morris except us." Do you hear what I'm hearing in this litany, this recitation? What Vermeil was saying was that he took a number of players who were cut from other teams, or who were not even drafted, not even wanted by other teams, and took this group of so-called losers and made them into a winning and high-performance organization. So what I observe in the newspaper is that these winning coaches have a belief, a strong, deeply held belief, that their team has potential, that individuals have the capacity to become larger and greater than they are. As a result, they provide intensive and continuous feedback. One of the best ways to develop somebody is to give them very heavy feedback. Now, the interesting thing that we see among professional sports is that if players do well, they get almost instantaneous reinforcement, and they get it from 50,000 people all at once. The crowd goes crazy. They cheer. They holler. They also do the other thing if a play doesn't go well. 50,000 people booing your name makes an indelible impression on your memory. And then the winning teams really work at this development thing. There's an intensive training program that means miles and miles on the track. It means calisthenics, working out with the Nautilus equipment. Casey Stengel was once challenged by a press interviewer. It was noted to Casey that he was awfully lucky as a coach. To this, Casey Stengel replied, "Yeah, the harder I work, the luckier I get." This development focus is not just an idle training program. It is an intensive, ongoing, day-in, day-out regimen. These coaches of winning teams seem to understand the old rule that you have to hire the best and develop the rest. A third major headline which emerges from the pages of the newspapers is that winning teams seem to have a very heavy planning and strategy emphasis. They go into this game with a very clearly conceived plan of attack. Not only have they studied their own performance, but they've studied the statistics and the game films of the teams that they are about to play. Each individual player has studied his opposing member and knows exactly what the weaknesses and strengths to exploit in dealing with this particular individual are. I have never seen a business that can match professional sports for the heavy emphasis on productivity measurement. In sports, that's called statistics. They run the stats continuously. I've been impressed, and perhaps you have, as you watch baseball or football or the Olympics, to see the numbers automatically come up on the screen as the computer spits out how well this particular player has done in running this particular play earlier in the season or over the last 5 years. This is a very intelligence-gathering business, this game of professional sports. There's videotape of the competition to study their moves. The game films are run after each game, usually on the day after the game. Each player has a chance to see his own play, for good or ill, run over and over and over again on the screen. I think that many people don't really think of sport as an arena requiring a lot of intelligence. There's this image of big dumb jocks, of beef cattle on the hoof. But I want you to know that this is changing. For example, in the NCAA, they've been raising the educational standards for college athletes. And now, before an athlete can be given his letter, he has to be able to identify which letter it is. Another thing about this heavy learning emphasis among professional athletes is that the players really internalize this value. This isn't just a value held by the manager. It's a value closely held by all the players on the team. It's not uncommon to see disabled players, for example, those that have an excuse not to be at the game, to be sitting there on the bench in uniform. Even on their off days when they might be doing something else, often professional baseball players are reported to be in the stands watching others on the teams playing out their contest. They are students of the game. Usually winning teams have a pre-game strategy, very much like chess players, very much like successful businesses. They have an idea before the game starts about what they're going to do. Now, of course, every game plan, no matter how carefully thought out, has to be altered and has to be changed to meet the contingencies. It's an interesting fact that when you look at business and industry, that those organizations having a strategic plan are generally those that are better able to weather adverse business conditions. They have a contingency plan. They're prepared if something goes wrong. If a major product disappears, they have something else waiting in the wings. On the other hand, losing corporations never even project that something might go wrong. If things get really bad in professional sports, there's always a timeout. I don't know if I could be happy playing professional football. After every play, they have a meeting. Every single play is followed by a meeting. You've seen it. They call it a huddle. What are they talking about out there? Why, they're talking about what the next play will be, making sure that everybody is coordinated. This is an advantage that people in business generally don't have. Although it may be more difficult to do in business and industry, I sometimes will see corporate executives establish retreats or departmental planning sessions where they'll basically try to find ways to get a little bit of a time out for a breather, a chance to take a more detached viewpoint. The last point I want to make about the planning emphasis among professional teams is that coaches usually assemble a solid assistant coaching staff. Some of the greatest names in coaching history have been builders of subordinate managers. They have an excellent offensive or defensive coach. They have excellent baseline coaches. They go out and recruit heavy managerial talent. As a matter of fact, these winning coaches are often the developers of the next generation of winning coaches that go on to become the big names in sports history in the future. This is the kind of individual who delegates heavily. This person stays out of the nitty-gritty. And I'm wondering, as you look at your own operation, does that suggest something? Do you have some subordinate managers that you're bringing along? Are they getting enough coaching help directly from you so that they can, in turn, multiply your effectiveness with the troops? Is there any reason to slow down this man or woman's ability to get ready for the future? Some people in management are afraid to develop strengths below them, so instead they develop cripples, people who are checkmated and really don't have much authority. Winning coaches don't make that mistake. They get very strong assistant coaches and bring them along as fast as they can. A fourth major trait about team development that seems to emerge as I read story after story about winning sports teams is that they are very selective in player assignment. For example, they tend to make their personnel selections based on what I would call a group averaging basis. Some teams will go out and try and hire a superstar for every single position. The problem with that, if you've ever watched an all-star game, is that everybody on the field's a prima donna, and they don't seem to be able to function well as a team. Winning teams seem to know that superstars are few and far between. There are a lot of above-average players, however, and so what they look for is what the team needs on average. In your own personnel decisions, when looking at candidates to bring on board, do you hire the best, most scintillating person that comes through the unit? That may be the kind of person you need. Or do you look at it on a basis of what the team needs? Maybe right now my team needs a pleasant personality that everybody can get along with, someone who can be a calming influence. It doesn't need another histrionic genius. If so, you might make quite a different decision. Winning teams seem to make their decisions with some consideration for their impact on overall team performance. A second characteristic of winning team selection processes is that they consider the position's requirements. That is, they ask, what does this job really require? They'll hire people to fit the position rather than hiring the most outstanding talent that's available. Once they've hired that person, they'll bring him in and play him in that position. And if he doesn't work out as well as expected, instead of firing that person or getting him off the team as a first prescription, they'll often do a lot of rotation. Winning ball teams are very quick to try a player in a totally different position, one he may never have played before. Nobody else ever let them, for some reason, or nobody else ever asked them to. Every winning coach knows that every player has to be played in the position in which his talent or capabilities can best be expressed. George Blanda played in the NFL until he was 48 years of age. I like to hear stories like that because it means I still have a few years of eligibility left. When he began his career, George was a quarterback. But after a number of successful years, he lost some of the accuracy. The arm was gone. But the legs were still good, and he was pretty fast, so they made a receiver out of him. They gave him a new job. Several more years, and the sprint speed dropped, and he'd gained a few pounds. He still had a lot of strength, so they made a running back out of him. And years later, when the body had been pounded pretty severely, his coaches let him wind up his career as a pretty good place kicker. His coaches didn't worry so much about what the job description called for, but rather tried to answer the question, what can George do for us now? What's the best way to play George? So sometimes you have to rotate them around, and sometimes that means you have to change the job requirements and change the assignments that people are given until you find the position that fits. Sometimes in business and industry, for example, I'll note that a manager will get very impatient because an employee can't do the job. And they'll even go so far as to terminate that employee because they haven't done the job well, kind of like Steinbrenner firing Billy Martin for the dozenth time. But winning supervisors, in business and industry, as well as in sports, tend to be those who say, well, how can we change that job? How can we fix it so that I can use this person's talent? Another way in which winning teams use players selectively is they'll set up special teams and they'll switch the way in which the subunits of the overall team are sent onto the field. In other words, just as winning teams are quick to tear up job descriptions and use people's strengths, so too do they tear up the organization charts to allow them to organize people in a different deployment pattern if that's what it takes to win. Maybe right now we ought to set up quality work circles or project teams and not be tied to the old organization structure. A last point to note about the use of player personnel is that eventually, after all the training and orientation, after all the possible combinations of utilizing talent, some players will have to be cut from the team. These are those who don't produce. Winning teams are very quick to move off the team those people who do not cut it. For whatever reason, it's necessary that they go. So don't delay with problem people. Fix them or fire them. But remember that you cannot win with losers. The fifth major headline of winning teams is that there's supportive interaction and open communication among the team members. There's an unbelievable amount of immediate performance feedback coming from teammates, referees, coaches, and the fans. There are always conflicts, particularly among winning sports teams, where the pressures are often the greatest. It's not uncommon to hear of arguments in the locker room, and at first this may seem disconcerting. The arguments and the conflicts that get a lot of press actually represent a group of people who aren't afraid to argue. They indicate a group of people who aren't afraid to confront their problems and their differences of opinion. Very often, their current disagreement is played out in the sports pages. These are strong people who are not afraid to have their say. In some organizations in American industry, we play a game of, let's not mention the fact that I can't stand to be with you in the same room. Let's pretend that somehow on the magic cocktail circuit between us that everything is peace and harmony, when in fact I'd like to stab you in the back if I could. The teams who win understand that you can't live in that kind of an environment, that you've got to get it said, get it out. You don't have to like what I say, but you're going to know how I feel. If there's a legitimate gripe or a complaint, then maybe something will happen to fix it. People who study conflict management tell us that the first step in most conflict management approaches is to confront and to surface the conflict. Say it nicely and with tact if you can. Say it nastily if you have to. And this is exactly what happens among winning teams. A lot of things get said in the locker room. Sooner or later, the problems, if they're going to be resolved, will be resolved only because of the confrontation and the surfacing of the problem. It's not enough, however, just to have an ability to surface conflict. There has to be in the communication atmosphere a sense of unity that eventually brings the team together. In 1984, the Detroit Tigers won the World Series. They were described in the press as the 25-man brotherhood. Just listen to these quotes from the players who beat everybody else in pro ball that year. Said Dave Bergman, "I don't see any heroes, and I don't believe in heroics. What I believe in is a 25-man roster that goes out, plays good baseball, and wins. Nothing goes to our heads. Everything here is great. The coaches, management, the media. But the best feeling of all is the appreciation of your teammates. Here's Darrell Evans. I've never been on a club where no one complains. I'm not just talking about chronic complainers. I'm talking about complainers for a day. There are none here. You can say it's the winning, if you want, that no club with a record like this would dare complain. But I saw it back in spring training. Nobody complained then either. They just did their jobs. Another communication factor among these teams is that the strong personalities and strong performances of players are mutually respected. Sometimes in business and industry and other organizations, we'll see the excellent performance of one manager become a cause of jealousy for another. But what I tend to see as the player rounds third base and runs for home on a winning team is that a number of his players have poured out of the dugout and are standing at home plate waiting for him with outstretched hands as he runs in. That's a picture that's indelibly impressed in the mind, I think, of any sports fan. If you'll pardon the expression, there's a lot of fanny padding that goes along with this. Have you seen the football players and how they act on a field? It's downright shameful. These guys are out there hugging each other and carrying each other off the field. They're excited. They're ecstatic. They're happy. They're enthused. One of my teammates has done the job. There's a lot of thrill in the other person's excellence and in their performance. I think it's because these winning team members understand this basic fact of group performance. We're either going to win this together, or we're going to lose it together. Finally, the sixth major headline describing winning teams is that they have a commitment to excellence and a kind of personal pride that is extreme. I don't know whether this excellence, commitment, and pride phenomenon is a cause of success or whether it's the result of success. It's very clear that the coach who makes the decision to win and the coach that has a kind of infectious belief in the team communicates that so strongly that the team catches that infection and begins to believe in it themselves, and that seems to affect the team's later performance on the field. A remarkable book written a number of years ago by Bob Richards, entitled The Heart of a Champion, contained a whole series of stories that characterized those men and women who became champions, whether in an individual sport or in a team competition. One of those stories concerned a little 7-year-old boy who was caught in a schoolhouse explosion. He lost half of his left foot, and his right foot and legs had horrible burns as well. The doctors said that he would never walk again. What do you do if you haven't the ability to stand? Well, if you have the heart of a champion, you go to work on your deficiencies, and you become the fastest runner in the world. Glenn Cunningham would become known as the Iron Man of Kansas, hold the NCAA and the AAU records in the 1,500 meters, and set a world record in the mile. There is something inside of champions that makes them transform a simple game into a triumph of the human spirit. For them, the game becomes their outlet for greatness, and they transform the game into something far more than just a game. McDonald's Corporation has become a symbol of national excellence. Twice as big as their nearest competitor, they consistently win in the marketplace. In almost any list of the best managed companies, they have set a standard of management worldwide. Yet they're only making burgers and fries, for crying out loud. But Ray Kroc used his business as an outlet for greatness and therefore transformed his game into something far more than just a business. Some of this lies in the degree to which the player of the game becomes self-invested, begins to sense that his personal pride is at stake. Let me ask you if you've seen it on the football field. Have you seen the player, the pass receiver, who goes out for the pass? The pass is thrown just right at just the right timing, but somehow he can't seem to get his hands on the ball. And the ball goes through his hands and the guy falls on the astroturf. He lies there on the ground and he is beating his fists against the earth. He is so frustrated at having failed his assignment. Have you seen the look of intensity on the face of the player who does his best, And no one in the stands blames him or calls it a bad play because they knew it was a tough one. And yet he seems to be self-critical. It's an indication of a person who is psychologically self-invested. It isn't just a job anymore. It isn't anymore just an assignment for which I'm paid. It seems as though this person has become so personally committed to success in this particular job, it's as though they identify with the job so much that the joy and the job are inseparable words. There's a heart of a champion feeling in this team. How can managers develop this in their teams? What specific actions can they take? One way in which this commitment to excellence is seen is in a team's resilience to failure. By that I mean the ability of a team to come back when they're down. It's a statistical fact that in professional basketball and football, more games are won or lost in the fourth quarter than in any other period of the ball game. That is, the lead changes hands between teams more frequently in the fourth quarter than any other quarter of the ball game. Sports broadcasters often refer to this phenomenon as character. A team has character, they say, when the team being down, being behind, being psychologically exposed to the sense of impending loss, is able to stay with the program, stay with the training, stay with the discipline, maintain the morale, maintain the thrust and the aggressiveness, and to be tough in the fourth quarter when you're tired and when you want to quit, to come back and win. That's referred to as character. I would call it a failure resilience, the ability to bounce back when things look like they're lost. How many times, and it's not a coincidence, have you seen a basketball game go into overtime and then into double overtime as two tough championship caliber teams battle it point for point? How many times have you seen a football game in the closing minute where a losing team comes back to win? It happens so frequently, and it's an indicator of this failure resilience. Right now, American management has a failure resilience challenge. I wouldn't say that our management has failed, but we've had some serious losses in recent years, and we're now going to see a test of the character of the men and women in leadership, people like yourself, and whether they're going to take this lying down or whether they have the ability and the strength to come back. Winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. Winning is not a sometime thing. It's an all-time thing. You don't win once in a while. You don't do things right once in a while. You do them right all the time. There is no room for second place. There's only one place, and that's first place.
You've been listening to The Uncommon Leader with Clay Sherman. Using the strategies presented here, you'll be able to achieve greater productivity at every level as you build and manage your own winning team. You'll want to listen to this program several times to make sure you've fully assimilated all of its profitable ideas. As with every Nightingale Conan tape, you'll find new information with each listening. To get results as a leader, you've got to be able to communicate with your employees. So what do you do when a person doesn't measure up? Dealing with problem people is one of the most frustrating aspects of management. Clay Sherman believes that losers in the workplace can become winners with the right kind of approach. He outlines specific strategies and techniques in another Nightingale Conan program called Managing the Problem Employee. Here's an excerpt from that program in which Clay discusses his employee counseling technique.
The defense mechanisms include such things as rationalizing what they have done. Whatever they have done, they have extensive logic to back it up. You will also hear projection of blame, that it was your fault or another person's fault. Or it was hard times growing up in the ghetto, the neighbor's fault, or problems in the family. You're going to hear partial truths, you're going to hear fantasy, and you're going to hear selective reporting. During all of this, your only response should be to encourage its flow. You should be saying, yes, I see. Then what happened? Tell me more. Go on. Inwardly,
You may be thinking, this is the biggest bunch of baloney I have ever heard in my life. But your role at this point is to listen. Just by listening, you are sending an important signal. To listen and nod and ask for more information is the behavior of a person who is on the other person's side. You may be rejecting a lot of what you're hearing. In fact, a lot of the stuff employees put out at this point is absolute nonsense or complete falsity. But in the midst of all this stuff coming down the river will be bits and pieces of information, things you may not have known, things which start to give you some insights. Recognize that you have started a catharsis. Around his problem behavior, the problem employee has put big walls of insulation, all kinds of excuses that have to be vented out of the system. In a sense, it's almost like an emotional storm or a psychological drainage. Until that emotion and anger drains out of the system, you are not going to be able to get them to the point of dealing with the problem in a constructive way. Some managers don't understand this process. They think that because the employee is giving out partial information or rationalizing, that the person is refusing to deal with the issue. In fact, he is dealing with it. But this first level of dealing with it is being expressed through the defense mechanisms. If you become sidetracked and get drawn into a discussion on any one of the points that the employee raises at this stage, you'll be making a big mistake. Say to yourself as you go into the third stage, I'm not going to respond except to encourage their talking. And if they say such and such about so and so, I am not going to get sidetracked or say, yeah, we'll prove it, or where's the evidence for that, or let's discuss that point. Don't get sidetracked. It will be absolutely counterproductive.
For more information on managing the problem employee and to receive a free catalog detailing other Nightingale Conant audio and video programs, please call us toll-free at 1-800-323-5552. Thanks for listening.